session of Writing in the Margins. I'm Anne Marie Russell, my last full day at Holden Village. Really glad that you're here. We have looked all week long at different types of writing. A lot of you have been here for some or all of those sessions. Thank you. We've looked at poetry and creative nonfiction and rewriting traditional narratives. And today we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about songwriting. And songwriting is fun to teach, and it's a little bit of a challenge to teach, too. And I'm glad to see you're all here. I think some people get sort of intimidated by the topic if they don't feel themselves particularly musical. I want to share with you just a little bit about my own process and my own story as a songwriter. And just for the sake of kind of illustration, look at a couple of songs I've written and kind of just unpack them for you so you see the process that I went through, me being just one of zillions of songwriters in the world. And then George, who's also a songwriter, who's been here all week, has a song that he's going to share with us and talk a little bit about it. And then we actually have a chance for you to work on writing a song. But we've got a melody for you, and Nathan's here, and we're going to help you. And you're really just writing some song lyrics today. You don't have to write a song from scratch and perform it tonight. Anything like that. So very non-intimidating way to kind of approach this. But I have always loved words, and I was laying in bed this morning thinking about what must have been the first song that I wrote. And so I have to give some kudos to my dad, Bruce, who's sitting over here, who himself is a songwriter and probably was my first kind of interaction with the fact that people made up songs, like from nothing to a song. And, you know, we grew up listening to music and sang lots of music and played music, but it was all music that someone else had already written that was sort of packaged or written out. And but then I had this dad that would write these songs from nothing to something, and I would hear him, you know, in the bedroom or in the living room, stopping and going, kind of writing things, scribbling, sort of watching this mad, furious process. And I remember being very intrigued by that and trying my hand at it. I remember writing a song and coming in and playing it for you, sitting on your bed in your bedroom and playing it for you. And I have no idea what song it was, but I just remembered feeling like you were kind of thrilled with me that I had actually tried that too. That was really fun. It was a good response. So then I became very interested in song, in this notion of words and how they come together with music. And at that point, past my middle school, like listening to Amy Grant and Michael W. Smith and a bunch of sort of 80s music, I stumbled upon the Indigo Girls, Emily Salyers and Amy Ray, whose lyrics I just began to fall in love with. And so I remember just holding it was a tape at the time, but like the tape jacket and following along with the words and being so interested in the way that this was like poetry and music, and that if I read it hard enough, I could sort of understand what it was they were saying, and I could sort of understand them. So I, you know, began to paint this picture of who they were as people. And then I just loved that they were two women, and they both play guitar, and their voices together were so interesting and different. And so I began to do some writing. And then I began to write and share those songs. And I would remember playing coffee houses in college and going up on stage with my guitar and sharing a song I had written. And it takes a lot of courage to do that, especially in the beginning. And even now, I think you write a song, and first of all, you decide whether it goes in the trash or not. That's kind of the first step. If you decide it's not worthy of the trash, and a good songwriter knows that for every good song you write, there's a couple that go in the trash, right? And that's just part of the, as a good writer knows that too, or a good musician. But when you finally have a song that you think, okay, this might be worthwhile, then you play it for people. And then you wait to see what they say. And sometimes your feelings can get hurt if they don't react the way you want them to. If you were at my concert on Wednesday night, I played a song called Autumn. Nathan played flugelhorn on it. And I remember writing that song before Nathan even had ever played on it, feeling very unsure about it, and playing it for the first time at a concert in Seattle, a house concert that our friend Carol, who's in the village right now, was at. And she came up to me after the concert with tears in her eyes and said, that song, Autumn, was so beautiful, was so amazing. And then as a songwriter, you kind of think, okay, well, that something I did worked, right? That was a good thing. So the next thing that happened, I would say, is that as I started, oh yeah.
I'm sorry, I'm still stuck on the fact that you're writing songs and throwing them away. not a songwriter, but to me that'd be like throwing your baby away. Do you just throw it away because you decide that sucks or because people won't like that? You don't like it or nobody else will like it?
Yeah, thank you for asking that question. I throw it away, I guess for lots of different reasons. Maybe because I think nobody's going to care, or because I wrote this music and this lyric and it doesn't go together, and it's sort of irredeemable. Like there's a song I wrote called Some You Leave Behind, and Nathan helped me actually sort of decide this was a song to throw away, which I really appreciate because it's a really upbeat, happy melody. It's very upbeat, but the lyrics are all about like a woman in a domestic violence situation and a man who's homeless on the street, and it just didn't ever fit together. And so that song is, I mean, I still know it, but it's gone.
Yeah, the lyrics and the music, do you save one?
Yeah, and I think that's part of the process is that as you're writing, you're even if you're throwing something away, any artist goes through drafts, and sometimes a draft is something that you directly take and you say, I like elements of this and I'm gonna fix it up. And other times, a draft can be something where you learn from the process.
Right.
And maybe those lyrics will come back sometime down the road with a different melody, or maybe the melody will come back sometime down the road with different lyrics, or an element of it.
Right.
But the idea is that through that process of engaging your brain and attempting to do something, you may not get it right that time, but you've gained from it, and the next time you sit down, you'll have a different creative energy that's going to push you in the right direction.
Right.
So throwing away doesn't mean that it is totally trash.
But a good writer, see, I disagree with that. I think a good writer has to, somebody said something yesterday that I didn't speak up about because I wanted us to just have a good discussion, but even a good writer, I don't think you save everything. I don't think everything we ever create we save. I think sometimes you create something and it was for the process of writing it, and as Nathan said, you learned, and it's there's too much to create. There's too much more coming up. There'll always be something else that you do.
Well, a great analogy is the possessions in our lives. We
right.
buy stuff, we go through time periods where we buy something that at that moment we think has value to us, and 2 years later we realize, I don't really have need for this anymore,
right.
And so we let it go. It's obviously it's a much more short-term thing with the songwriting process, because oftentimes you sit down and 20 minutes later you realize, this isn't gonna stick, but it's that idea.
Right.
And a lot of times those choices that we make, something we buy a few years later will affect our decision of what we're gonna buy, because we'll then have a mindset of, I'm not going to need this in a couple of years, so I'm not going to buy this now. And so it's the same idea of the songwriting process, where we think we want to write about a certain idea or concept, but then when we actually write it, we don't like that concept. So then a couple of years later, as we're writing again, even if it's not a conscious thought, our mind is now reconsidering how to approach a topic so that it's more
right.
Along the lines of what we would want
right.
from our product.
Right, yeah.
You said Indigo Girls turned you on to lyrics.
That's the grand question, right?
I'm trying to figure out how you came up with a happy, upbeat tune
right.
about domestic violence and a homeless man. Yeah,
right, right.
It is irredeemable. You should throw it away.
It is, yeah. the lyrics aren't happy, you know. It's about walking away from things that are bad and kind of moving forward. But I myself, Anne-Marie, I don't ever write just the music. And I am a musician, but my strength these days lies in words. And so either I write the words and the music comes after, or they come together. But that's just me. I mean, there are, you know, I think a lot of people, especially more mainstream songwriters, will write a beautiful tune. And sometimes then someone else comes in and puts lyric on top of them. And I bet Elton John writes his...
Yeah.
Right.
But I would bet that the majority of songwriters out there that are writing songs that have words in them are lyric driven. I would think that most of them, they get an idea for what they want, and the words come out earlier than the melodies do, and the melodies are created after. I don't know that for sure, but just from my experiences in music and working with different artists, that would be my guess, is that more often than not, the artists have a concept for the song and an idea for what they want the message to be, and then the music is...
Right. If you're a lyric
sometimes
songwriter.
Sometimes comes alongside,
yeah.
but sometimes comes a little bit after.
Comes after.
That's like the Beatles did,
huh?
The Beatles. Often wrote the melody.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Which seems to me makes sense because mark, in terms of markability, the lyric, I mean, the lyric is beautiful, but the melody is what catches you, it seems to me.
I think that depends on the person as
yeah.
well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah.
But there's no right way to do it or wrong way to do it.
No.
It's whatever works for you.
Yeah.
And I think that even a lot of artists do it, they probably have a more consistent way that they do it, but they depending on the song, they would have a different approach to it.
Right.
But I like the freedom of letting things go.
Yeah.
It's kind of like building a sandcastle at the beach. You don't expect it to be there
right.
tomorrow.
Right.
But you still build it.
Right. And there are songs I've thrown away that, like, there's some lyrics in my head from a song I wrote probably 5 or 6 years ago that has stayed with me. And then that sort of, that's a nudging. Like I threw it away. I don't have it written down anywhere, but I know it in my head. I still know those lyrics, and I can still hear the melody that went with them. And so then I'll pick that up. I think, and this is true about poetry, too, and about poets. I think there's this idea that you just sit down, you're inspired, you sit down and you write this song and out it comes and it's done, right? But that's rarely or never the case. There's always a couple of songs on the shelf that I wouldn't play in concert yet because they just still need more work. Like I like them, but something doesn't fit, something isn't right. And so, I just wanna show you a couple of my songs in a minute and kind of talk about where they came from, but what I wish I had were the drafts that they went through, because almost every song goes through drafts. And then what's interesting, so Nathan and I just recorded last summer, Nathan produced an album for me, and we shipped a bunch of stuff out from the East Coast to the West Coast and set up a studio at a beach house in Oregon. And I had these great players, this drummer and this bassist from Portland who I'd been playing with for several years, brought those guys out, brought out two buddies of mine, twin brothers from college who are guitarists and vocalists, and we recorded this album. And even the way that my songs changed, so before we did the album, I sent Nathan this, what did we call them, like demos or like rough tracks. So I just sat down with the tape recorder and played my songs, the songs I wanted to record, into the tape recorder and sent them to Nathan. And he like started listening to them, and he really musically like helped to shape the songs, make them interesting. He did things like that I would never have thought about, like how's this song starting? How's it ending? We don't want every song on the album to start and end the same way. We want something to be different. And there are a few songs that sound similar, like Easier to Run turned out sort of the same. Free in many ways turned out sort of the same. But there are a couple songs, like When I'm Gone, which is the song I ended with the other night, that Nathan actually took and I mean, he created if you know it's music, the modulation, it goes from one key to another. And he wrote that part. And so this song took on this whole different life. Another song on my album called Romulus, which started off just being this sort of straight, like, nice rock song. I mean, what did we end up doing to it? It's like this Cuban or, like, Latin,
kind of like a Latin
feel with, like, the beat on the four, which just threw the whole song into this totally different, you know, feel. And so when we go back and listen, I deleted all those. I can't even stand to have them anymore. But Nathan has them. And when we go back and listen to what was and what is, I mean, so the song was done, right? I had written it. It was done. I had been playing it in concert, sent it to Nathan, you know, and then together. And some of that was in the studio, like this energy between musicians that as we worked on it became this whole different life form. And now that's how I don't go back and play those songs like I did before. Like when I'm playing in concert, I play them now to what they've become. So even once a song is written, it evolves. And that's true for a lot of songwriters who then have producers. And I mean, that's why this music business, it's complicated, but I think it's also lovely because there are people who are more into music production who understand how to take those pieces of a song and sort of evolve them. You know, I'm sure if you sign with a big label and that song gets out of your hands, it could go a direction that you don't want it to go. And that can be our cousin, Greg Eklund, was the drummer for Everclear, the band Everclear, for a while. He's not anymore, but he's playing with Storm Large, if you know who she is. He's drumming, right? Is he still drumming for Storm Large? Yeah, he's playing for her. But they had signed with Capitol Records, and they just felt like Capitol Records sort of took their music and kind of screwed them, basically.
They got a big signing bonus and then basically signed all rights away.
Yeah, and they just...
artistic.
And then they kept saying, you need to, and one of the things they said to them is, we need we need like 3 really good songs and 7 kind of crappy filler songs. I mean, and then, because then they said, well, we have 6 or 7 good songs. Well, no, save some of those for the next album. We don't want to use all the good songs on this album. So it's this whole right business. They have this song on their next album that's called You Make Me Feel Like a Whore. And it's about Capitol Records. I mean, Capitol Records doesn't, I don't think they know that it's about that. But that song, if you went out and found it on iTunes and listened to it, it's all about kind of their relationship with the music business and how that made them feel like they had kind of sold themselves, you know, in a way that they weren't expecting. So just to keep going so we can keep moving, I just wanted to come back to one thing, which is that the end of my college years are in my, I guess I would say my early 20s. So I'm in my mid-30s, upwardly moving toward 40 right now, just to give you a sense for where I am in my narrative story. But I happened upon some musicians who, there's this whole, especially in like the 80s, early 90s, there's this whole genre of like Christian music that was very cheesy, that I wanted nothing to do with. I mean, just nothing to do with. But as a person of faith whose sort of spirit and soul is poured out in the songs that I write, I felt really out of place because I felt like there had to be a place that my music sort of fit in that context where I could still be myself, write from my heart, from my inner voice, from my soul, and say the things I wanted to say, but not in a sort of typically packaged way. So I landed, when Nathan was in college, we were visiting him, and I went to this UCD store, and I found this CD by this woman named Carrie Newcomer. I don't know if you know who she is, but she lives in Indiana, and she's a singer-songwriter. She's Quaker, and her view of the world is very irreverent and lovely, and I just loved it. And she wrote about these very meaningful things, very spirit-filled things, and I began to listen to her lyrics, and I followed her career, and I've seen her in concert many times. And David Wilcox is another singer-songwriter who I believe is probably a person of faith, and that just comes out in these little ways, and I began to see snippets of that kind of writing, and that was really inspiring to me too, to think, like, I don't have to fit into this marketable package and sort of be hung out to dry with this genre of music I'm not that interested in, but there's a way to sort of be myself and say the things I want to say, you know, as I write. So... anything you want to add to that I want to show you just a couple of songs, and I'm just going to show you them, and then, oh yes, thank you, play them. So this is the first song on my new CD. It's called Free, and one thing I will tell you, especially on this song, is that I wrote the chorus first, and then I wrote one verse and put melody to it. Then once I had the melody, I wrote the other verses. Okay, so that, I kind of got a form. But, so I was thinking, I had this whole image in my mind about just, if you've ever read anything by Michel Foucault, and he's a postmodern theorist, and this notion of the panopticon, where, right, so the panopticon is the center of a prison, and that these prisoners, that there's this place up above where somebody can always watch them. And so whether someone is watching them or not, someone could always be watching them, and that was a way to make them want to behave, right? And so how in our culture, in some ways, whether we're watched or not, we always feel like somebody is watching us, and we have this constant kind of feeling like, and wow, how nice it would be to feel like we could just live our lives and not feel watched. And so I began to think about people I knew and situations where people were sort of living life authentically in a way where they weren't watched. So I wrote this chorus, I'd give anything to be free, 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 I'd give anything to be free. Really simple, just not, it's not complicated lyrically, but this sort of sound. And then I began to think about places. So I have a friend, her name is Laura, and she dances in the kitchen all the time. And another friend of ours wrote a song about that, and I got to thinking about that. So she's the girl, she's my girl. There's a girl down the street, dances to the radio in the kitchen when no one sees. And I wonder how it feels to dance that way, hidden from the gaze of the world. So then, the poem that we read in my sacred poetry class called The True Love talks about this man in the Hebrides who every day walks on the stone, saying his prayer to the turbulent Jesus in the water. So here he is in my song. There's a man, lives alone on an island by the sea. He walks the shore to greet the day. And I wonder how it feels to know yourself that way, hidden from the gaze of the world. So that's that next verse. Then I started thinking about another person I know who lives without a gaze watching her, my daughter Maya, who's now 6. But here she is now. There's a kid I know, lives inside her head all day, her truest friends, the ones she breathed to life. And I wonder how it feels to live in such a way, hidden from the gaze of the world. So these are 3 examples, right, of people who are doing that. And then finally, I brought it back to myself and thought, you know what, Amory, there is a space in you where you're doing that. And here it is. There's a secret girl living deep inside my soul, planting words that blossom into songs, and I love to watch how she coaxes them to life hidden from the gaze of the world. And so that's how that song sort of came together. And I'll play it for you, and they can come in. Sing, and sing, and
I'll just sing it.
Okay. There's a girl down the street, dances to the radio. Just with the drum. It's called Las Mariposas. And it's from So when I was teaching, I actually wrote this in conjunction with a songwriting assignment I gave. I was teaching high school in Mercer Island in 2000, and I was teaching a world studies class, and we were studying the conflict in the Dominican Republic, and Trujillo, the dictator, and his uprising. And we were reading a book by Julia Alvarez, who's a Dominican-American. She's a professor at a university, I believe in New York, but I could be wrong. And she wrote a book called In the Time of the Butterflies. And it's lovely. If you haven't read it, you should go get a copy of it. But it's the story of four women, the Mirabal sisters, who were very instrumental in the overthrow of Trujillo as the dictator. And they had this underground society. And their code name for each other was Las Mariposas, the butterflies. And that was how they were referred to in this underground movement. And three of them were actually murdered. Trujillo moved their husbands from this one prison to another prison because they would go visit them once a week. And then he planted assassins. And three of them went and were murdered on the way back. And then the one sister, Didi, was left to kind of carry on the revolution. And Trujillo, as we know, was ultimately overthrown. And they were very instrumental in that. That was very inspiring to me. And part of what I did with my students is I taught them about kind of the movement of protest songwriting. And so we looked at several different protest songs and how artists had written, used music as a way to protest things. And they had to write protest songs, and so I wrote one also, which sort of morphed. It's not exactly a protest song, but it morphed into that. And so I began to sort of think about the Didi, the sister who was left, and kind of the story that she went on to tell. What's interesting about this song on the recording is that it's my voice and drums, two kinds of drum, right? The toms, kind of a drum set, toms, and then a djembe. And are there some shakers? And no. Is it just djembe and the drum? And then there are three male voices that sing backup on that song in this beautiful kind of chorally sound, which I love because to me that feels like the voices of the people, and there's reference to that. And also, these three women died, but their husbands joined the revolution and kind of carried it on. And so, symbolically to me now, those three male voices represent the husbands and Didi, the voice, as they went forward. So, so this is really just all about kind of their story and where we went with that. What time is it? So, I don't think I'm going to sing this. I don't think I have time. But you can get the album and hear it again if you want to listen to it. I just want to make sure we have some time for George to come up and share his song too. So, and again, the one thing I'll say about this song is that it sort of came together. I sang it for a long time, just me. It was just a cappella when I would do shows. And my husband kept saying, oh, you have to put drums to it. But I just didn't ever really know what to do. Sent this song to Nathan, and he did three things to it. He figured out how to put drums to it and slowed down the first section. So when I sing it, the drum voice starts, and then I sing, I was a young girl with hair long and dark, when they called me a fighter for freedom. But it's not in any sort of time. It's kind of free verse. And then the drum plays again. And then I talk back to the drum, and we have this back and forth. This whole section originally was all in time. So we took that out of time. And then we made two small changes. There's one place after, where is it, Nathan? Can you scroll down a little? So this part, no, my sisters, can you see the light in the eyes of our children? And oh, my sisters. And then Nathan added this 3-4 bar of drum, which I think is a prelude to this, the pounding of the hearts. 1, 2, 3. Can you hear the pounding? And you changed that line, actually, too. Because I sang, can you hear the pounding? And Nathan said, can you hear the pounding? Which just changed the melody ever so slightly, but made it sound more interesting. So then, after the beginning part, which Ron actually played with me in the concert, then it starts moving into time, and then there's this sense, almost, it's not militant, but it's like, it's people, it's the gathering of people that come together, and this kind of, and here Didi, she's singing, in some ways she's singing about her, but it's all we, it's this whole kind of communal story of this uprising and these people. So that song, again, you know, I had the original idea, but as we went toward the recording, it came together in a different way. So it's kind of interesting to see how
this. And you can sing it after the class for us.
Oh, yeah, I mean, I'm happy to sing it. I just want to give you a little time to play around with some stuff. So, George?
Sure.
George Schweitzer?
Yes.
And George has been actually at all my sessions this week and came up to me, when did he come up to me, George, a few days ago? And said, I'm a songwriter, I write songs, and I said, would you be willing to share one with us and just talk a little bit about your process? So you hear a different voice talking to you. So he said, I don't know if my songs are so appropriate for Holden. I said, I'm sure you can find something. But she did, it's lovely, the song is lovely. So it's Living for the Good Times. Uh-huh. So we just typed it up so you can see it, and
thanks.
Looking forward to hearing it. Thanks,
sir. Yeah, so this is a bleeding edge song this year. I usually go by the music. I use that to inspire me to to come up with the little impetus. That's what I'm always looking for is something. And so I find it very difficult. To get started a lot of times, especially, I write a lot of dribble and stuff, but it's as much as I love songwriting, especially when it's very gratifying when I get something done, it's a very difficult process for me. And so anybody who's out there, keep going, because it's worth it, it's a lot of fun. So this, so a lot of times for me, the one piece of the song will help you write something else. So, in this one, once I was able to come up with the chorus, it kind of pointed me to the contrast of what I'm trying to say with the chorus. So, with that, that's about all I have to say about it. So, I don't play for people that much.
You're doing great. Don't worry about it.
Before I get started, I've discovered it's not for everybody, but there's a software out there for recording and stuff is awesome nowadays. Mm-hmm. There's Pro Tools and Reason and all this stuff, but it's just fantastic. So if you get that far, it's pretty fun. Anyway, so here we go. Despair. Thank you.
to just try your hand at playing around with words a little bit. So here's what we have for you. A melody that we hope is sort of familiar to you, but also not just like Twinkle Twinkle Little Star. And it is, come on, they're up there on the... it's a Beatles tune. It's a Paul McCartney and John Lennon tune. All My Life?
In My Life.
In My Life. The places I remember. You know that song? We'll sing it for you in a second. And then, so what Nathan has done is sort of given the words to the song and then counted out the syllables on those spaces below for the verse and then kind of the chorus or the, I don't know what exactly you'd call it, right? Here's a bunch of hands.
Yeah, this song is a little more simple in the sense that it doesn't have, it's not the verse-chorus form in the sense that a lot of pop songs function with. There's really just kind of a single structure.
Sort of say something, right?
and there can be some flexibility with the syllables as well.
Right.
If you notice, I mean, there's kind of the general concept is the first line is 8 syllables long, then the second short phrase is 3, then the third one is 4. But in their little third moment of doing it, the second line is longer with lovers and friends. They actually add stuff. So, but rhythmically, if we're trying to match it to this melody, to a small degree, you want to have the melody in your head to make sure that the accents and the syllables and the inflection is gonna work with what the melody is. So do your best, and we'll obviously try. Obviously, if any of you want to sing your own, you're very welcome to. And if not,
but if you want to share yours, we'd be happy to sing
it for
you.
Yeah, I would be happy to sing it for you, so you could hear what it is.
And if you want to sing it, you can.
So places could go into our creation. So you didn't give the song that had the lyric of "There are places I remember"
no.
to kind of guide.
That was just
that
so
just
you could hear the concept
right.
of the
no,
melody
you're
and
you're
what
not
the
writing a second
are.
Verse to this
but
song.
But this is your, you could write something that connects to this theme or is a totally different song just using this melody.
So I'm writing in 10 minutes.
The pressure.
Yeah. Right.
We should try to do this too. Gift to you.
creating joy and loving heart.
Nice.
Yeah.
Very nice. Someone else?
Any others?
You gonna sing it?
Oh, sure.
You should. Please, please. But Nathan, can you hold up that?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Tell us your name, please.
I'm Tim Blake, and I was just before I came here, I was climbing up the Copper Falls.
Oh, I love
Falls, I have two syllables, so it's Copper Basin. But it's something that really happened to me. I discovered martins. They have the big eyes. Squirrel looking things, the big eyes. Okay. I was climbing Copper Basin. Out at me, giant eyes that spoke of wisdom. I'm blinking from his pine tree. I reached right down for my camera to capture him so I could take him home. He stood still patiently. I was too slow.
Very nice.
Well, I think that was a great example, too, where in a few of the lines he altered the number of syllables and where the inflection was to make the message work. And even if you actually go on and analyze the later verses in the Beatles song, too, they continue to do that, where there's kind of this general idea that they use, but then depending on the verse that they're in, they'll change the meter a little bit to fit the message that they want to communicate.
Another one or two here?
Nope.
You want to
sing it?
What, do you want to sing it or do you want us to sing it? We can sing it. Yeah, it's a...
You read the places I met with people.
Lovely. You can just go for it. Because we're just going to run out of time.
When I think of all my dear ones, those I love throughout my life, I remember back a good time of laughter together.
In the morning I awaken,
what's coming. I can honor all that comes my way. And while the path is never straight, like I expected, what's the chord? Like I expected.
Sorry.
And nothing I do will make it be. I can open up my heart and see the goodness as life unexpectedly sets me free. Thank you for coming this week, for coming today, and for participating in all these things. So just say keep writing. And I meant to mention at the concert, but I'll tell you that you can actually find Anne-Marie Russell online at annemarierussell.com and on Facebook. And I do play shows around the area, so if you log on and Facebook friend me or send me an email, I can let you know and if I ever come and play where you live. So.